This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. Welcome to the Dirt Bag. Here, the second Wednesday of every month from 11 to noon. The Dirt Bag, a garden variety show. Jim, my normal guest, is, I think he's in California at an olive symposium or something like that. And then he's heading to Italy for more olive stuff, I believe. So we'll have a report on that for next month. But this month, I'm very pleased to welcome back Chip Buebel. Chip, are you with me?
I am, I think.
You're there. I can hear you.
Okay, wonderful.
Chip is wonderful. Chip is at, as I'm assuming he's at his place of work there in St. Helens.
Yes, I am.
Yes, and his place of work is the county extension agent, the OSU extension office. Mm-hmm. And Chip has been the county extension agent for, what did you say, 46 years?
44 years.
44 years.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're very...
And I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Yeah, apparently, to go for that long in one location. I sure appreciate that. And I appreciate you coming on today. This could be one of our last times in your official capacity as an extension agent, but we can still call on you from time to time and talk about what things are going on.
Yes.
I'm not sure when I first met Chip, but he's been a guest on the Dirt Bag, I don't know, half dozen times maybe.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
And every time, it's wonderful.
Quite a long time ago.
Yeah. Do you remember when we first, must have been Master Gardener.
It was the Master Gardener program. I was teaching, you know, a number of the classes in the metro area, I think.
I did my training in 91, so I've had a possibility of meeting many people along the way. But
right.
Now I keep in touch with Chip mostly through his just gosh darn wonderful newsletter that it's available to anybody, I think. Is that not correct?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's online. Just go to OSU, Oregon State University Extension Service, Columbia County, and then go down to newsletters, and it's called Country Living. And it focuses on gardening and then, you know, some other topics, you know, some sort of natural resource topics and some farming topics as well.
Yeah, and, which are kind of fun to read through for a lot of people. And one thing that caught my mind, stuck in my mind, is that one reason that I just enjoy the newsletter so much is that I think we're somewhat kindred spirits, or at least for our experiences. And one of your recent newsletters, you were mentioning about the trying to essentially reseed or seed a meadow for wildflowers or whatever you want to do. And you said in your experience, and this has been my experience too, that the big bugaboo for all of that is grass. Mm-hmm. It just keeps coming back up, and I said, yeah, this guy knows what he's talking about, because, you know, I've experienced the same thing. And
we made an interesting discovery recently with regard to that. There is a native plant called yellow rattle, and yellow rattle is actually parasitic on grass. And so people are starting to use that in some of their floral, native floral mixes, meadow mixes, to reduce the grass competition tremendously.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not an easy plant to get the seeds of, and we're still learning about it, but it's not very common. I know I've talked to some people in Clackamas County that have found it. People that, for example, raise livestock don't like it in their pastures because it's weakening the grass, which is what their livestock eat. But somebody trying to do a meadow for pollinators and other species, it looks interesting. But it's a long way off from being from real utility at this point in time.
What's the mode of action there? I mean, in the root zone.
They interact with the grass roots and basically steal all the goodies from the grass plant, and it gets weaker and weaker and weaker.
Oh, this that's interesting.
It's really, really crazy, actually.
Yeah, yeah, we need to support our extension service. That's for darn sure. Anyway, well, see, that's it. You know, Chip has all these things right there. So we've got a full show here. Even without Jim, we've got plenty of things to talk about. And we'll be talking most about vegetables and other things, just like Chip was saying there. Our plant of the month that I've, and I'll give you the backstory on this, is carrots. We'll talk, you know, I'll get to that in a little bit here. Also on when to harvest for peak flavor or storage ability and things like that, all that. And also maybe along with that is storage ideas. I know we've talked about this in the past on the show too, but it's nice to have that. Our at half past the hour, we have a garden stumper related to carrots, believe it or not. And our Dirtbag Dictionary term is nitrogen fixing. And we talked about that, and one of the garden stumper questions that I thought would that I thought about was saying, are there any other nutrients that plants need that need fixing? I thought, well, that might be an interesting topic, but I don't know anything about that. And of course, we answer, encourage your questions. 503-231-8187. I'm pretty confident that Chip can handle just about anything our listeners could throw at him today. And finally, what's annoying me, and this is really an annoyance, and borders on maddening. In that, and I'll just throw it out there, and we may have talked about this in the past, is that why water rights apparently aren't subjected to eminent domain? I'm not, this is a rhetorical question, Chip. I'm not directing this at you, but it seems like if they can take a house to build a freeway, that, you know, if people need water, that they might be able to somewhat reallocate water rights that are owned for a century and aren't being used for the original intended purpose.
I mean, water rights stay with the land. So when the land is sold, the water rights stay with the land. So whoever purchases it, and that's at least that's the frame in Oregon. Each state actually has different rules on water. But in Oregon, it definitely stays with the owner of the land that the water right was on. If you are not using your water right, you can potentially lose it. If it's what we call an agricultural water right, if you're not using it, you potentially could lose it. Actually, it's the lack of water rights or the lack of available water for irrigation for some small farmers. They buy a piece of property and don't really look to see whether there was a water right or not. And they think they can just drill a well and use it. And you can't. You can use it for your own garden up to a half an acre, but you can't use it to sell. To sell the produce from. So, yeah.
Okay.
So,
well, it's, you know, the push is going to come to shove at some point, and in some states it already has. Of course, it was pushed down the road a little bit with the good water year that the southern, southwest states had. But anyway, enough of that. I'll just remind you once again, our phone number, 503-231-8187, if you have a gardening question. I chose carrots as our plant of the month just to talk a little bit more about this little tidbit of information in one of the recent newsletters that carrots need, what is it, up to 9 inches of water at, or no, not carrots.
Onions.
Onions, yes, that was it. So, but carrots, you had a piece there. We'll get to that onion question in just a moment. But you had a piece there about the carrots on what it takes to grow these, you know, straight or, you know, bulbous carrots without being gnarly or multi-rooted or whatnot. Give us some ideas on that.
Sure. Well, basically, it's the water in the ground. Like so many things, water in the ground and the sunlight. but carrots don't like their growth impeded at all, and so they like a, and they also like a soil that's kind of open, if you will. So a fair, in fact, there's some, a lot of carrots that are being grown in eastern Washington and a little bit in eastern Oregon on irrigated land on very, very sandy ground. And you think, wow, that's got to be a job. Well, it is a job in terms of making sure it's continuously moist just to the carrot's needs, and that they're being fertilized, provided nutrients in regard to, you know, their stage of growth and what they need at those various times. So, you know, really heavy clay soils can cause gnarliness and sort of stumping. If you water and then it runs dry for a little bit, the carrot thinks, oh, this is very strange, and starts to grow in odd ways there too. So really attention to detail on carrots.
Uh-huh.
And raised beds work as long as you don't have anything, you know, in the raised bed like mice or something like that. They work really well for growing good carrots, given the right. And you also have to have a decent spacing. We tend to, when we seed carrots, we don't always go through and remove some of the smaller ones.
Yeah.
And make sure that the ones you have left have enough room to get a canopy to have the leaves, and the leaves grab the sun, and the sun makes, and that process, photosynthesis, makes the sugars and the starches that make the carrot. And so each carrot has to have enough room to be all it can be, and when it does, it'll grow pretty well.
And thinning of carrots is one of the most tedious thinning tasks one might have to do.
It is, and it's actually painful for some people. I mean, they just see it as sort of a crime to have this thing that germinated for you, and it's growing, and it's for all intents, as far as we know, happy, and then all of a sudden plucked and destroyed, or maybe eaten it well before its prime. You know, it was interesting for years. Carrots resisted any attempt to be transplanted, you know, to start the seed in something else, in a plug tray or something like that, and then to be transplanted. They just hated it. They wouldn't grow straight. It never really worked until the clever Dutch figured out that if you leave the carrot, you watch the carrot's seedlings in the plug tray, and if the roots hit the bottom of the thing, you're almost too late. And if they start turning up from the bottom, you are too late. So there's this really critical moment when you have to get them out and into the very nice soil and transplant them.
Huh.
And but they are doing that now. So they have cracked that code of carrots.
Is that mechanically transplanting?
Yeah, usually mechanically transplanted, yeah. in larger operations, yeah.
Because I can't imagine doing that for one carrot at a time.
No,
but
no.
Well, I suppose it'd be worth it because homegrown carrots are pretty darn tasty.
Well, yeah, for you know, a gardener, it's actually worth a try. But boy, the timing on that's really critical. You want all the seedlings to be coming up uniformly, so
yeah.
It kind of needs to be a nice place you can have it done. But yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, no, I think.
So the keys there are, you know, constant moistness,
mm-hmm.
and a looser soil.
Mm-hmm. A looser soil, for sure.
Friable. And I guess it mm-hmm. could be anything as long as the nutrients are there.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, yeah. Before we went on mic today, we were talking about some raised beds. You mentioned raised beds work well mm-hmm. for carrots, and that you that sometimes the carrots aren't, I mean, the raised bed soil that one might purchase is not all it's cracked up to be.
Yeah. So this has been an interesting complication for people trying to build raised beds, because the often the soil mixes that are being sold are basically sand, maybe a little topsoil, but often not, and then some organic matter, usually bark or some wood fiber, but it's in various states of decomposition. And the problem with that mix is that, in twofold, one is that the sand really does drain quickly, so that you have to pay attention to. It also doesn't hold minerals super well, so that also you have to pay attention to. But a real challenge with those things are that the undecomposed organic matter when it's out there and getting watered, you have all these decomposing organisms that start to work and start to renew the decomposition process, uh-huh. to compost that material. But what's happening is they're grabbing all the nitrogen, free nitrogen, in their own little bodies, and your plants can't get it until maybe 3 months or 4 months or 6 months later, when the composting process kind of winds down as it's more complete. So anyway, you end up having to add nitrogen, whether organic or conventional forms, to support both the decomposition and the growth of the plants. And that can be true on a variety of different kinds of plants. It's probably the least true on, maybe some of the greens. But boy, for most plants, it's a requirement almost. And people really get frustrated why things don't grow in this new raised bed mixture. And it's really a nitrogen issue for the most part.
Is there any way to know what you're getting before you get it?
It's really a mystery tour when you talk to people that are selling it, because often the stuff changes from week to week, even based on where they're getting it from. There's an amazing lack of consistency. If you have access to really good compost, stuff that's already really well composted, that's a good addition to the mix as well, besides simply adding nitrogen. That can be very important. Liming can be important as just part of a normal garden process to add some lime. Those aren't bad things but in the end, watching the core nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium is pretty important. So you would need something that will provide a better set of nutrients than what you're actually buying when you get it straight from the yard.
Yeah, sometimes I say, well, you know, take advantage of the pathways that you're walking on. You know, maybe shovel some of that topsoil into your raised bed. And I also say, well, you don't need to fill the bed all the way up the first year.
Correct.
You know, you've got soil below the below too.
Right.
So, and this is a good time. We'll talk more about raised beds, beginning a raised bed maybe next month or the following, but this is a good time to be thinking about it if you want to start one and you have a weedy patch or grass that you want to convert to a raised bed, that, next time you can, get the weed whacker out there and just whack those weeds down to the soil level as much as possible. And then if you have access to leaves, I mean, who doesn't really? Pack them in there. Well, I don't mean pack them in there. Put them in there. And, 4 or 6 inches deep, even. Mm-hmm. And come springtime, it'll be, the grass should be pretty much gone. And and furthermore, what I recommend is to don't remove the leaves if you don't need to. Just make holes through the leaves down into the soil. And you could put your, depending on what you want to do, you could put your, well, I would wait to put the to fill the raised bed in until after the grass is killed by the leaves. Then you'd want to move the leaves. But I frequently, when I put leaves on my well-established raised beds, I just leave the leaves there and then use those beds to plant, tomatoes, for example, that I can just remove a little bit of the leaves and plant the tomato right into the soil.
Sounds like a good program.
Yeah, that's part of my lazy-ass gardening method. Oh, did I say that? I meant to say laissez-faire. Okay, well, let's take our first musical break here. I think this might be, this is a little tongue-in-cheek here, the theme for my musical choices today, I called it, It May Not Be COVID. Take a listen.
Something to do with you. feeling kind of dizzy and weak in the knees. I've been in love before, but never so bad. You're in my system and it's driving me mad. I caught a touch of your love. It came on overnight. I must have held you too tight.
Hate to turn that one down, but so be it. That's Diane Schur and the Count Basie Orchestra.
Okay.
Boy, if you ever want to listen on how something or a lesson on how to swing,
yeah.
That's it right there. Yeah, Diane Schur. She's a blind singer. She's probably 70 now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're back here at the Dirtbag. We've got Chip Buble on the line, the Columbia County Extension agent. And I do want to talk about just a little bit about watering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from we started talking about little watering, and that was from the carrots. They need a moist surface. But once again, now coming back to your newsletter about the onions, I just found this fascinating. Well, tell me about that.
So onions are really an interesting little plant. If you start them from seed, which is quite possible here, and not a bad thing to do, they grow, you know, kind of slowly at first, and they're pretty, you know, pretty not very competitive. So you got to keep all the weeds away, and then they get better and bigger and stronger, and then with a certain day length, where it's a certain shortness of the night, longness of the day, they will start to bulb. And this is where an onion gets very particular about how it's being watered. Because once it's starting to bulb and to grow that bulb, if it runs pretty dry, it will stop. And you may try to, you water it again, and it won't restart. So if it gets dry enough, you can completely stop that onion at mid-bulb, and that's what you get. You don't get anything more. The other thing is they are tremendously demanding of water. At their peak of bulbing, where they're, you know, two-thirds of the way through the process, they're using up to, you know, 9 to 11 inches of water a month. And given the fact that, you know, normal, you know, August and July are giving us a half an inch, maybe an inch at most of natural rainfall, mm-hmm. It really is sort of an obligation to keep that soil with your own, your own watering system, you know, reasonably moist all through that cycle to keep it uninterrupted so that it doesn't stop. If you have good, you know, if you have good humus in your soil, good organic matter in your soil, you have a bit of a buffer there because that will hold and release periodically. If you have really sandy soil, you have to water a lot more often because it goes through so quickly. You water less each time, but you water much more often and still try to hit that target of between 9 inches, 10 inches, maybe 11 inches, depending on your soil. So anyway, it's a funny little crop that way.
Yeah.
Garlic, on the other hand, we historically have, you know, this is a fall planted, you know, bulb. You're planting the cloves, and so it's in October. The rains are going to come, so you really you're not thinking about irrigation at all. You don't want to irrigate them up. There's no need to. You put them in the ground. You won't see them unless you dig one up, and you'll see the roots are forming, but you won't see the tops usually until mid-January. It's normally when they show up. But again, all the watering is just fine for them. And historically, I've I've felt that, and this came from actually experience working with a fairly large onion and garlic company years ago, that there was no need to water after about June 15th. You actually wanted them to begin to dry down, to kind of be ready to harvest, and just be a firm garlic at that stage of the game. So their roots can go fairly deep too, actually. But anyway, we've had a couple of years where we stopped getting rain in May, and that does not work as well because it's more difficult to count on any natural rainfall. And so I think in some years, watering after June 15th is a good idea. And looking towards a mid-July kind of harvest. So sometimes it's not an absolute rule. I have backed away from that. So anyway, that's something for people that grow garlic to think about. Sometimes some watering is more important than you might think in late May, early June.
And then at some point we would stop watering both onions and garlic. I mean, if you need to water garlic.
With onions, you're kind of waiting for them to bend over naturally. Sometimes you have a variety or just a growth pattern that year that they don't really bend that much. But usually, when the tops start to fall over naturally, that's when you all watering needs to stop and you're just letting them dry down at that point in time.
And just one more thought on this watering, then we do have a phone call that we'll go to next. Is there, I've read, that, well, maybe we should, or maybe you should, I see this in books or whatever, publications, stop watering your tomatoes in end of August or something like that.
Yeah. So this is one of the things that I'm not totally sure about, because I actually have come to the conclusion late in my career that there's probably different plans for different tomatoes. Obviously, the what we call the determinant tomatoes, those are mostly grown for making tomato sauce and things like that, where you get a big yield all at once and put them up and that kind of thing. But most of us grow a lot of indeterminates too, because that's where a lot of the flavor for especially fresh eating is. Mm-hmm. So I'm not generally in favor of shorting them of water, because it tends to increase the issues with what we call blossom end rot. It's a shortage of calcium, and you get this brown spot on the bottom of the tomato. But it is driven by partially uneven watering, and so I'm in general in favor of keeping even watering on tomatoes up through almost, you don't want to cut them off in August.
Yeah, that's been my thought too.
Yeah, I mean last year was interesting. It was crazy. We couldn't plant till it was 22. We couldn't plant until mid June. I mean, it was cold and wet and miserable. But then all of a sudden we had a year that lasted until the last week in October.
Yeah,
it was warm and so.
And the tomatoes are going to be producing that whole time if.
Yeah, yeah.
The indeterminates can be.
I was a little worried this about a week ago. I thought setting up for a pattern of maybe 3 or 4 days of kind of moist, wet weather. That didn't happen. But there's a disease called late blight, which is horrible, and there's no resistance in tomatoes to it really. And so if you get that 3 or 4 days sometimes in a row where it just is wet all the time, that can end your season, and I was thought, oh no, the season can't be ended this quickly.
Yeah,
it didn't.
Nope,
so we got through it, and we're good now. So,
okay, that's great information there. We still have our caller.
Yeah,
Roger. Oh. Okay, good morning, Roger. You're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning. I just had a question about a dahlia garden. We grow dahlias throughout the summer. About 26 to 30 of them. I keep them in the ground for 2 to 3 years, and then I dig them all in the fall and get rid of the tubers and buy new tubers. Okay. Every year I try to amend the soil, but I just want to do something that's better on amendment. What amendment do you recommend? And also, when is the best time to put that down? in the fall after I dig the tubers? Does it soak in during the winter or in the spring before tilling the area or what?
Okay. So two comments. One is that they do benefit from having some lime, and lime is best interacts with soil, you know, really changes the pH and, you know, starts to begin to provide available calcium if you apply it in the fall. So that would be something after you dug your tubers, I would work some lime in and then let it sit. And, you know, if you have an area where you've done that, I normally say 10 to 15 pounds per 100 square feet, 10 to 15 pounds per 100 square feet. And that'll last for 4 or 5 years. So once it's done, you don't have to redo it in that place again for 4 or 5 years. So anyway, but the advantage of doing that in the fall is good. The other nutrients, though, are much more soluble. And so you would want to then do that fertilizing at planting.
Oh.
Yes. Chip, what kind of lime? Are we talking dolomite lime, calcitic lime, ag lime?
So the two lime materials, the regular ag lime is all calcium carbonate, 100% calcium carbonate. It's a ground up rock and limestone. And then there are some limestones that have a fair amount of magnesium in them. So those limes are called dolomite limes, where they're basically, again, a little bit depending on the rock material that it came from, somewhere around 85% calcium carbonate and 15% magnesium carbonate. And so if you haven't added magnesium, we're not totally short of it, but we're not, you know, it doesn't hurt to do that once. So I suggest when people are liming that if they're liming something every 4 years, 1 year with ag lime, 1 year with dolomite, or four years later, dolomite, and then 1 year, 4 years later, ag lime. And by then, you're probably done gardening or something. I don't know. But yeah, anyway.
You'll have moved by then.
But if you haven't added any magnesium in any form, I would use the dolomite lime at the same rate.
Uh-huh.
10 to 15 pounds per 100 square feet.
Now, the additional question I had is, for soil amendment, do I need to go out and get some steer manure or anything like that to add into it?
How does your soil feel? Does it feel nice and friable when you dig it and handle it and stuff like that? Does it feel good?
Yes, it does. Yeah. My dahlias do well. Kind of put some bark dust down, a light layer in the spring to keep the weeds down and to hold the water in. That I mulch in every couple of years. But, you know, it seems to be doing well, but I just wanted to, if there's something better out there to add, then I will.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I'm hesitant to trust with something to change something that's working well. So I would say just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Roger, did I hear you say that you dig up the bulbs and throw them away?
You know, yes. I used to divide them yearly. And what I do when I leave them in the ground, I cover them up with plastic to prevent rot and freezing. But after so many years, you know, the tubers just get so large. We're ready for new ones. I will divide them or give bunches away to friends or family who want some, and then the rest, you know, I get rid of.
Yeah, I would suggest that it's probably mostly that they're just getting crowded and they really need to be divided. And the same holds true with rhubarb, that it's just they're not as productive when they're so crowded together.
But, well, I appreciate the answers on this. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet.
Okay.
Dahlias are a neat plant. We've gotten kind of interested in growing what are called the open-faced dahlias.
Yeah. The collarette.
Collarettes. They're bumblebees are absolutely nuts with them. And
so are honeybees.
Are there and all sorts of other things. Yeah. So
I've started writing
growing those.
Just a kind of a public or a human interest column in the Beeline, Oregon State Beekeepers, about, you know, my favorite plant this month. And I just got done submitting my favorite plant for October, which was dahlias.
Yeah.
Because honeybees are, it's a great source for them and other pollinators. You'll see them on the same, you know, with bumblebees and maybe some flies, the same blossom.
Yeah, I think they're great. Another I mean, some of the older sunflowers are also pretty interesting for pollinators. They bred some so that they wouldn't shed pollen onto somebody's kitchen table, which then is not a good thing.
Are you talking about sunflowers or dahlias?
Sunflowers.
Okay.
Sunflowers, yeah. And so you want to buy the ones that, you know, are really good, solid, true sunflowers. And boy, they're popular too.
Yeah. Okay. Do we have another call? No. No. Okay. Well, let's go to the garden stumper. Have we got our theme ready to go for that time? The garden stumper theme. Anyway, the number to call to try to answer it or for a garden question. Okay, you've got some pretty good chance on this one, I think. And remember, the first person that calls with the correct answer gets a free garden hand tool sharpening at Coley Farm Store, Northeast 42nd and Alberta Street. So the question, fairly simple. Carrots were originally what color? That's it. So if you know the answer to that, 503-231-8187. Coincidentally, that is the same number if you have a question. So, all right, let's move on here a little bit. Let's see, we've talked about water, you know, how much water a garden needs. Well, we talked about a few things, but it also talks, it really depends on the soil type, and you... You made mention of that. If it's sandy, you'll have to water more often, but not as long, probably.
Right. Yep, that's correct.
Okay. So, you know, if we say, you know, onions need 9 to 11 inches of water a month, it may be, you know, maybe 6.
Right.
It may be 11. Right. So it just depends. And, you know, that question you asked from the dahlia grower was good. You know, well, what does the soil feel like? You know, is it friable? You know, does it clump up when you drop it and just keeps in a clod? All of those things will affect the amount of water that you'll be needing there. So, okay, what else did I find glean?
Well, I'm getting a lot of calls on people wanting to save their own seeds. They're talking about doing that, and there are some seeds that I think for gardeners are pretty easy to do. I guess one of the primary ones people are saving are tomatoes, and they're pretty straightforward. There's sort of two theories on how to save them. One is just take the pulp and spread it on a piece of paper toweling with the seeds and the pulp all mixed together. When it dries off, just pick off the seeds and put them in a storage container, and either put them in the refrigerator, or I tend to prefer the freezer. So.
Uh-huh.
There's another theory on tomatoes, too, is to take the pulp and let it ferment for a couple of days and then remove the pulpy material kind of as before and then just have the seeds dry. And that, in theory, may reduce some diseases on tomatoes. So I'm actually going to try that this year. I've saved it in the sort of the paper towel way, but I'm going to try the pulpy way this year and see how it works. So anyway, those are pretty easy.
Is that the tomatoes, are those just heirloom varieties? I mean, you wouldn't recommend trying that for hybrids or?
Yeah, no. Anything that's labeled a hybrid, you don't want to. You won't get what you started with.
Yeah.
So. But most of the tomatoes people are growing, I would say, are non-hybrid. Well, that's not true.
Not sun,
but a lot of them are non-hybrid tomatoes, and they are pretty well straightforward in terms of growing them. Green beans, we grow some pole beans. Still prefer that, and so it's an old variety, and it's we've been able to save seed for years on that.
What variety is that?
Well, actually, I don't know the name of it. Okay. I got it from somebody who it was a Chinese variety, and I've just held on to it, and it's been very, 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 very tasty and productive over the years. So you just keep saving the seed.
Yeah,
peppers are a little touchy. Go ahead.
No,
ahead,
I was just going to say that I've done the same thing with Blue Lake, and I've been using the seed for maybe 20 years. So it kind of, and then it, you know, it adapts to my climate.
Yeah.
Or your climate.
Absolutely. I grew up actually with picking pole beans.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Well, picking pole beans, strawberries, and raspberries were the ways a youngster made money.
Yeah. And, yeah. Me too, down there in the valley.
Yeah.
All right. Yep. All right. Let's get to our calls here, Chip. Sorry to cut you off there.
Sure. No problem.
Okay, Ty. What do we got? Okay. Good morning. You with us?
Yes, I'm wondering.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm wondering if it's still safe to eat a piece of rhubarb that I harvest out of my garden.
I'm sorry, your line wasn't great. What was the question about rhubarb?
Is it still okay to harvest and eat rhubarb, or is it too late in the season? Is it dangerous?
Okay.
I don't.
Glenn, do you want me to try?
Okay. Yeah, sure. I don't think it would be dangerous. I mean, unless you eat the leaves.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to eat the leaves. Right. Oftentimes with rhubarb, there's a first flush of stems and leaves. You know, and it's obviously the stems that we eat. And then if you don't harvest those, they kind of die back. And then there's a second flush. And especially if there's enough light and things like that, and they're getting enough water. And the second flush may be what you're seeing now. If it's the first flush, it's way too fibrous and would be very pretty much inedible. But if it's the second one, it might be okay. So
okay.
A little bit depends on how old the stems are.
Great. So it's just a matter of too fibrous.
Yeah, and sometimes go ahead, Chip. Finish your.
No, go ahead, Glenn.
Well, when I harvested just one stock to see what was the quality of it a week ago, and it gets a little pithy.
Mm-hmm.
At least these do. But I don't think there'd be anything wrong with cooking it up. Chip,
okay,
what do you think, Chip?
Well, I don't think it would make a very good end product. Being that pithy, I think the textural issues would be very different. I think
yeah,
it would
that's
be
true.
Actually unpleasant. To the best of my knowledge, I don't think there'd be anything toxic. Although I don't know that for sure. I mean the leaves. It's the oxalic acid that. Is the concern, but anyway.
I've never heard of anybody being sickened by eating stalks of any age.
No, I haven't either. But it, I just don't think you'd like it. I guess I'll put it that way.
Okay.
Probably not worth it.
Have
an
issue like pokeberry.
What about
So pokeberry is a whole nother story. That's become a weed around us here. We have quite a few people that have found it in their backyards, and the birds take it there. So pokeberry, the leaves have to be treated in a special, secret way that only Southerners know. And
from what I understand, it's just like the very first leaves that are even considered edible.
Right, and I think they have to be like boiled three times or something like that.
That would make sense. Yeah, no, that's too much for my laissez-faire gardening as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
Sure.
We have another call there, Ty.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm new to community gardening, and I've got these sunflowers that I planted that are absolutely huge, and I want to leave some for the birds. But they're much huger than I thought they would be, and I need to take some of them out so I can plant my fall crops.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know how to dry sunflowers. You know, like so
yeah.
I can have sunflower seeds.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, just take them off the floral head and put them on a piece of paper inside, and they'll dry just fine.
Are they, Chip, do you have to wait until you know that they are mature enough to do that? Or how would you know that?
But you can usually tell as the color changes on them. I mean, you know, as it goes from a light color to the deeper colors.
So the ones I have are kind of like striped. When I see those stripes, are they ready?
Right.
Okay, so do I just lay down the whole head and all the seeds will dry, or do I have to take the seeds out of the head?
You could do either, but I think you could lay it down in a dry place, and it would dry successfully.
Yeah, especially these next 3 days.
Great. Okay. Yep. I was supposed to be really hot the next 3 days.
Yeah, around 90.
Yeah.
Okay. I will harvest them and dry them like tomorrow then.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know whether, you know, urban rodents are interested in those, but I think they might be. So it might
be
dry them inside rather than outside, unless you wanted to create a cafe for them.
Okay. Well, I've got a really small apartment, so that's not a choice. Okay. But we'll try.
Okay.
Squirrels are the big issue. For me, I mean, I grow the sunflowers, and the bees get to them first, but then if I leave them, squirrels are crawl up the stalks. And,
well, that would be okay.
Yeah.
So if the ones I've got, like, over a dozen mammoth sunflowers, they're like 10 to 12 feet tall in my garden plot, which is like...
That's
so the ones
I
leave, well, can the birds and squirrels just harvest them like they are?
Yeah,
that's part of the reason I planted them.
Certainly, but they'll wait till they're, you know, almost ripe.
Okay.
And in the meantime, you know, you might have squirrels.
Right. So I'll take the ones I want and then just leave the rest.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Okay. All right. I see the phone ringing there again. Ty's working it here.
Sure. That's great.
Are we... Okay, Brian's with us. Good morning, Brian.
Yes, good morning, Brian, guys.
Good.
Did you guys get an answer for the carrot thing?
No, we haven't had any answers yet. What do you got?
Oh, okay. What I think is white, right?
It's not right.
It's not right.
No.
But I wanted to mention, if you guys have ever heard of Korean natural farming, I bought a book. His last name is Cho. I don't remember his first name, but what an amazing technique to use your resources in your yard to grow food. So you can make pesticides, you can make fertilizers, you can harvest all the fungal activity around your yard, and, you know, not spend a dime, you know, virtually no expense. And I think it should be more spread out, because this is, in essence, a fight against, you know, commercialized agriculture. It's hurt both the farmers and, you know, the consumers. So the more people know about these things, these techniques, the better. And I was just curious to see if you guys have had any comments or have ever heard of Korean natural farming techniques.
Chip, I haven't.
No, I haven't either. I did. There was a Chinese gardener, he's been dead for a long time, but was one of my early introductions.
Was that Peter Chan?
Yeah, Peter Chan.
Yeah.
Peter Chan,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, actually, the very first book he wrote is amazing from a gardening standpoint. Anyway, no, I have not heard about this. So what's the name of the book again?
It's Korean Natural Farming, and you can find it on YouTube. It's very... it's this guy, he's a Korean farmer. His dad was a farmer as well, and they devised methods to combat the proliferation of corporate farming, and just devised all these ingenious ways of using their surroundings, you know, what they do with weeds. Let's say, for example, you pick the most prevalent weed in your yard. Don't throw it away. You know, you pick it, you put it in some water, and when the water breaks plant down, you can just use that water to irrigate your garden with.
Okay.
And all the nutrition in the plant. And I'm just really being really not very descriptive, because I'm just
we can check it out
to understand and use these techniques. And my garden just made a complete my own, you know, resources, and it's a fascinating way of dealing with making food, you know, and also the fact that you can make your own things, you know, it empowers the farmer, the gardener. It's just a fantastic way growing food.
That's worth checking out.
Yeah,
great.
That idea of sort of water composting the weeds is an interesting one as a liquid fertilizer. I would think, yeah.
I knew the French
had a thing with nettles.
That you can make all kinds of not only fertilizers but also pesticides, natural pesticides. It's just an amazing, and there's a series of books, one dealing with the pesticides, one dealing with the nutrients, and it's just really detailed. This guy has a PhD in agriculture, and he's very well studied, very well researched. The books are very well translated, and they're just a fantastic resource for any gardener.
Okay. Great. Well, thanks for calling and passing along that information. I've written it down. We'll check it out.
Yes.
Okay. Rich, does Rich have an answer or a question for us?
I think that carrots.
Okay.
Dark purple.
Purple is the correct answer. All right.
That's good.
Rich, if you're interested in getting a free sharpening at Cully Farm Store, stay on the line, and Ty will get your phone number, and we'll pass that along to Cully Farm Store, and you can bring in a tool in the next year. Thanks, Rich.
I'm lucky.
That's right. And boy, it sure makes a difference to have a sharp tool. You know, whether that's a shovel or your hand pruners, makes a big difference. Okay. Ty, we have more phone. We're not going to have any more musical breaks, by the way, here. We got too much to talk about here. So, yes, purple. I think maybe Afghanistan or something like that. My research showed me, but
yeah.
Let's see what else here. Oh, yeah, cover crops. This is the time. We've got about less than five minutes, Chip, but we can do something in that length of time. This is the time to get going on cover crops.
Yeah, so, I mean, Glenn, I don't know which ones you prefer. Crimson clover and Austrian winter peas have been kind of popular with gardeners around here, and I think both work well, and they do something called fixed nitrogen.
Yes, and that's our dirtbag dictionary term, so just fold it all in there and talk about it.
Okay, well, nitrogen is in our atmosphere.
Yeah, and about 80%.
About 80%, right, big time. And so there are some very clever bacteria that have learned how to fix the nitrogen and offer that, in essence, as they colonize the roots of the plant, like a bean or a pea or some of those, to share the nitrogen, but also to get nutrients from the plant itself that allow them to thrive and prosper in a new ground. So it's a very symbiotic relationship. And so when the roots of those plants break down, when they're done with, or when you rototill them in, at over time, the fixed nitrogen from the air becomes the nitrogen fertilizer that your new plants can use when you plant in the garden. So it's a really nice circle, and very important for, I think, will be increasingly important for agriculture over time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, yes, crimson clover and fava beans are my favorites. Just because they also, when they do bloom, they offer up forage for insects.
Right. So, fava.
All of them probably do.
Years ago, yeah, I experimented years ago with fava beans as a potential crop. We had one dairyman out here at that point in time who wanted an alternative winter cover crop to something that fixed nitrogen, because he wanted to be able to basically work down the fava beans and then plant corn right into it. Then he used for corn silage for his dairy. Anyway, long story short, the problem with the fava beans were that they did most of their fixing about 2 weeks after he needed to plant the corn.
Oh.
So
yeah,
the concept was good, but it didn't quite work for him in his situation. But no, any of the legumes are great. And short term, I mean, you still could do buckwheat if you wanted to for like a 40-day cycle and work that in and then plant something else.
Yeah.
I suppose, or, yeah, so there's a lot of options.
And you can plant some of them up until, I don't know, maybe the rye, maybe up until, I don't know, November 1st or something?
Yeah, yeah. Any of the winter grains you can plant actually quite late.
We just want to clarify, those aren't the nitrogen fixing.
No, they aren't at all. But yeah, winter oats, winter barley, winter wheat, all are desirable. There are, I know one grower, commercial grower, who actually uses spring wheat, and he basically counts on good fall growth and then allows some cold weather that he hopes for in late January to basically sort of stop them.
Uh-huh.
And that's an interesting concept. But there's enough plant material at that point in time that holds. You know, hold does what he wants it to do in terms of the soil and the soil surface.
Those are his main reasons, not necessarily the organic matter that is also
Well, no,
present.
The organic matter is part of it, is definitely part of it. But it's also weed management, and there are often fields that he needs to get on maybe earlier than
he.
We're also seeing some of our organic growers using tarps to what we call terminate the cover crops, and that's changing the dynamics of it too, where they sort of mow it and then cover it with a tarp that gets no sunlight through. So
how long do they tarp? Leave the tarp
like
on.
Three to five weeks.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
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 So it's just wonderful how.
A lot of stuff people are trying to think to try, you know, trying to figure out how to do everything you need to do with a cover crop, which is to, you know, you get the soil tilth built up, you suppress the winter weed population, and then have all the other nutrients available from the plant. So it's a really important cycle for organic growers.
Well, our cycle has come to an end, Chip. We could probably go on for another hour. We have enough information to talk. It's a busy time of gardening year, too. So Chip Buebel of the Columbia County Extension Agent, at least for another month or three.
Yeah.
But no promises after that. So it's always a pleasure, Chip. Thank you very much for sharing so generously your knowledge.
Well, thanks, Glenn. I enjoy doing this. It's a lot of fun always for me.
Great, great. Okay. Well, we'll have him back as retired agent, I'm sure. This is Glenn Andreessen. Thanks for listening to The Dirtbag, a garden variety show. Mm-hmm.